Thanks, Mark. My name's Lyle, and I'm an alcoholic. What a beautiful Saturday morning to be here with you, so thank you for having me. Thanks for that beautiful hotel room that you gave me. There was a nice fruit basket in there, and that's not always done. I really appreciate that as well. Yet every time I see one of those, it reminds me, and I always tell a story because I don't see those very often, of a large conference that I was at, and a lot of people, and they had the first two rows all reserved for committee members and speakers and all of that, and they were all sitting there. I had gone up to the podium, and I was thanking them in some detail, describing this basket that was in my room that I really had enjoyed, except there wasn't any basket. And I was just doing it because I was watching the other speakers on the front row. I could see them just kind of barely turn, and I knew they were saying, "I didn't get a basket. Did you get a basket?" That was worth the effort. I'm from Stockbridge, and I'm not from there, but I live in Stockbridge, Georgia, on the southeast edge of Atlanta. My home group, Stockbridge Group. So if you're there on a Monday or Thursday at 7 o'clock, we meet. Please come see us. It was kind of humorous that a year or so ago, several conventions almost consecutively didn't get the hometown right, and it wasn't a big deal, but they had me bent down as being from Stockton, Georgia, Stonebridge, Georgia, and another variation or two. And I thought, you know, the best one that I had seen was when Barbara and I were in England a few years ago, and they had printed up this deal, had me down from Stockingbridge, Georgia. And the Brits were curious about that, and every time they'd ask me, "Where's Stockingbridge, Georgia?" I told him it was right across the state line from Pantyhose, Alabama. anyway, Richards asked me if he could tape this, and I said, yeah. I was just in York, Pennsylvania, about two or three weekends ago. And when these two dates came up, I said, "Well, I don't want to do that." I said, "You know, I'm just going to be there within two or three weeks of each other." And they said, "No, those are completely separate AA groups. You know, they don't go to ours, we don't go to theirs." And I said, "Well, I don't want to show up, be an instant replay." And they said, "No, that's all separate." I'm standing out here, and three people came up and said, "I just saw you in York." Well, you're gonna hear basically the same story again. I don't change the story around. I have thought about doing it, adding some drama, and telling them, like, when I came out of prison, this time I was on death row, and instead of, it's an honest program, so I don't do that. But let me start. You know, we're supposed to talk in a general way, what we were like, what happened, what we're like today. And the other thing I sometimes throw in there is that I used to say what it was like, and I didn't think it was a big deal, and I still don't. Some people do. Some people do, because I've heard talks about that. But I didn't, and I'd gotten a real cryptic email from a guy who identified himself as a old-timer in Southwest Georgia, and he said, "Well, I'm listening to one of your CDs, and you're misquoting the Big Book. I've got some newcomers here, and you're misquoting the Big Book." And I thought, I don't quote the Big Book to start with. You know, I know a number of speakers who do, and I don't have that gift. They can come up, when they start throwing phrases out and paragraphs and page numbers, I don't know about the page numbers. I know I've heard the material. I've been through the Big Book a lot of times, but I can't tell you where it is. And I don't do that because I don't have that particular gift. And he said, "You're saying what it was like instead of what we were like." Okay. Is that better? Can you hear me now? So anyway, I sent back the perfunctory AA apology. "Well, I'm sorry. I'll try to do better." And that apparently didn't register very well. And I get another one back, and he said, "Well, it's really kind of important," because he said, "If I was sitting with some of us old-timers, we're on the front row, and you started that way, we might just get up and walk out," thinking that if you're going to start by misquoting the Big Book, the rest of it can't be that good. So that kind of tweaked my competitive spirit at that point. And me too. So I sent him back another email and said, "You know, I didn't know this was going to be a continuing topic of exchange between us, but I said, as long as it's taking place, let me just remind you, it doesn't say when we read how it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly memorized the book. And that stopped the emails. I didn't get any more back. But you know, AA has its own way of working. And about 2 years later, I'm down there speaking at the Flint River Roundup, and he is my host. So, but he made his point. I never have said what it was like. I'm going to mix the order up a little bit and start with what happened, and then I'll come back. And a couple of things that I need to mention here up front. I'm not going to have time to do a big, long drunkalogue, and I think it's important that there's enough in there about drinking that people identify with, but I'm really pushed for time. I've got a timer up here, and I'm going to do the best I can to get through the next 2 hours and 38 minutes. And but I really am pushed to get through this story because there's a lot to it, a lot of good stuff to it, and I don't have time to get it all in. And so I'm not going to be able to take you down the long drunkalogue road. My drunkalogue is pretty much the way I always hear people. I drank too much, too long, too fast, and things happened. And I never thought I was an alcoholic, never thought I was going to be an alcoholic. As a matter of fact, I was sure I was not going to be an alcoholic. And I had some benchmark comparisons because both of my parents were alcoholics and they died from this disease. So I could always look at them and say, I'm not like them, I'm different. I looked at other alcoholics. I had a very thin picture of what an alcoholic was. They were folks that lay in the alleys and doorways. They were dirty and filthy, and they drank out of brown paper bags, and they were passed out on the grasses of the parks and laying on the benches. Those were alcoholics. And I was not in that realm, nor was I ever going to be until I got a little bit better education and picture of what a real alcoholic was. But when I got into treatment, the thing that marked, I think there's a big distinction, a big difference between comparing my external vision of what an alcoholic is and actually learning about the disease of alcoholism. I had no idea about the disease of it, if in fact I even believed it was. But once I got into treatment and they started going through symptoms of alcoholism, every one of them belonged to me. Every one of them. I didn't have anybody getting in my face or poking me in my chest saying, you're in denial, you're an alcoholic. I'm just laying there at night because I can't sleep, replaying all this stuff. I'm thinking, God, that's me, that's me, that's me, that's me. And of course, the big one is that when I start to drink, I'm not able to shut it down. And that's not my intention when I take the first drink or two. That's not my intention at all. And there was a time when I could manage that, and the big book talks about that. But towards the end, I couldn't do that. And so I have come to the easy realization that I am an alcoholic. Didn't want to be, thought I wouldn't be, but I am, and I'm here. And as things have worked out, I've learned to be grateful for that because of the things that it's forced me to have to do. My entire life is better as a result of that. And that's certainly not true when we first get here. I don't know anybody that comes in here, excuse me, on the wings of victory, which is a particularly poor choice of words in my case. But we don't come in here because we're holding a hot hand on a winning streak. And I'm amazed that I got here. I'm amazed that I was open to listening to what was taking place and that I agreed to stay. And I wouldn't have it any other way today. On the morning of my sobriety date is March the 7th of 1990, the date of my last drink. And an event occurred on March the 8th, early in the morning, that had never taken place before. And that was an entire airline crew was arrested for having flown from Fargo, North Dakota, to the Twin Cities, Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. I was the captain of that flight crew. I'm also very aware that most of the time speakers come to the podium, we're talking about recovery, and when they walk away, you don't know what they did for a living, or career, job, whatever, and that's as it should be. So the introduction of the fact that I was an airline pilot is in the context of the story alone and only for that purpose. That had I not been an airline pilot, had I been a doctor, an attorney, construction worker, electrician, plumber, or anything else, none of the publicity that came screaming after me would have taken place, nor would I have set myself up for a federal felony conviction. You know, I see pilots particularly show up in the news nowadays. It's old hat stuff. It's not a big deal. They show up in the news, they've been pulled out by TSA or somebody. Their picture might be there. It might be a short, brief mention of them. And the second day, they're not in the news. I was the very first airline pilot ever arrested, tried, convicted, and sent to prison for flying under the influence. And that was a huge, huge media sensation back then in 1990. It was massive. And I was on the news for weeks into months. I didn't think it was ever, ever, ever going to end. Of course, it was picked up by all the late-night comics, the tabloids, everything. I saw everything printed about me, said about me, the jokes that went along. I made Jay Leno's monologue for a long time. And another part of the story that I don't have time to go into, he called me in June of 96 and apologized. All of that was torturous. All of it was torturous because none of this is who I am. It's not what I was about. It was never what I was taught to do. And the idea that I would bring disgrace to everything that I held and cherished in a dear sense that had value to me was not part of my life plan. But that's what happened because I'm an alcoholic. I had the instant overwhelming feeling that I had when I walked off the airplane the morning of March the 8th into the waiting arms of airport police, FAA officials, and Northwest Airlines officials. The instant overwhelming feeling I had was one of total, complete, immense shame and disgrace. And I used to struggle to try to get that description across, try to convey exactly what that was, and the Big Book says it in a way that I'll never be able to better, and that is when it talks about pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I don't think it can be said any better, or more shorter, or more succinctly than that. But the shame and the disgrace went to my very bone marrow, and it became a crippling, really crippling thing when I got into treatment. As the days unfolded, it just got exponentially worse to the point where I was on the dark edge of suicide. And I looked back later, I thought, why did it hit me so hard? And it hit me so hard because I had been the guy in my family who had raised three children who were grown and gone. And I had constantly been the standard bearer for things like duty, honor, country, character, honesty, integrity. You do the right thing. Those had been my hallmark traditions in the family. And suddenly, I have, by my own personal example, rendered all of that null and void based on the fact that I'm now in the public eye. I'm on my way to becoming the greatest embarrassment, shame, and disgrace in all of American commercial aviation. And if I'd had a name like Smith or Jones, it might have been okay. But with the name that I've got, my kids were constantly being assaulted by questions and stuff that was going on that they're based on what their father did. And in that context, I think it's been my observation that the great tragedy of alcoholism, as I see it, is not what happens to the alcoholic. It's not what happens to me. It's the suffering and the horror and the grim and the tragedy stuff that comes to my wife and my kids, my friends, my family, and everybody who cares anything about me. I bring all of that to them as a result of my alcoholism and what I go out and do. They get to share in it. I'm a big boy. I can take what comes my way. I believe when you do what you did, you get what you got. I'm a big, hardcore believer in personal accountability and being responsible. If it's all about me, that would be okay. But it's never about me. It's about everybody around me when all of these things unfold. We were detained for 12 hours that day and went to two different facilities and gave blood. And it was at the second facility where there was a reporter who saw two uniformed cops and three uniformed airline pilots and thought there might be a story there. Now, these things had happened at Northwest periodically. Northwest was, at that time, excuse me, was the only major carrier that did not have a program for alcoholic pilots. All these other carriers had those programs. Those programs dated back to the mid-70s, and they were highly successful programs, highly successful. Northwest had refused to go along with the rest of the industry. So I knew what happened at Northwest when every 3, 4, 5, 6 years, some pilot got in difficulty and it reached the company's attention, and it ripped through the rest of the airline like wildfire. Pilots and flight attendants heard about these stories, and we heard about them. I mean, they just ripped through us. So I knew that the outcome was immediate, irreversible, irrevocable termination. And those stories circulated through the airline. I remembered the names of various people I'd known about and the details as best we'd been, as best they'd been related, the locations where these things had happened. And over the course of that day, the millions and millions of thoughts had tumbled through my mind. I thought, that's my legacy. That's how I leave the airline. That's my record. And that's how I'll be remembered. And God, that hurt. God, that hurt. We were finally released. We gave sworn statements to the company attorneys, and were released. I got back to a commuter apartment that I had, and for the first time that day, based on the trauma, the shock, and all of the things that were unfolding in front of me, I suddenly thought, I'm supposed to be home tonight. This was the night I was supposed to land in Atlanta. And so I called my home, and Barbara waited out there for me for 4 hours, and I didn't show up. And when I called home, my answering machine picked up, and I didn't know what to say or how to say it. And I got a very whispered message out that it had been a disaster. I thought I'd lost my job. I'd be home the first flight in the morning. I do not know why my wife didn't call me back after having received that message. Later, I saw that as a real gift. I was just so sick at heart. I was gut sick, heart sick, and I did not want to talk about any of this. I got home the next morning on that first flight, and I exited the airport very quickly because I knew a lot of people. I didn't want anybody to stop me, see me, talk to me, or anything. And I walked outside the airport, and I saw Barbara parked off to the right over by the curb. I've never told a story, but what I didn't say, I felt like I had to climb over the curb to get in the car with her. Pardon me. A little reflux going on here this morning. At any rate, I got in the car and could not look at her. She and I had been married a long time, and she pulled away from the curb, and all I could say is, honey, I'm so sorry. She said very softly, she's got a soft South Texas voice. She said, who better than I might possibly understand how you feel right now? We drove home in silence. Again, another gift that I didn't recognize until some time later, because I thought, what wife, having learned that her husband had just trashed a 22-year golden career as an airline captain, would not have said, why did you stay? You knew the Northwest policy. You've seen this before. Why didn't you go back to your hotel room? These are questions that she had every right to ask. And I had no answers for any of them. I just didn't know. And she didn't say anything. We drove home, and she went to work. I was just in this state of mind where I didn't want to be in my skin. I couldn't stay still. And a few minutes after I'd gotten home, I didn't know who to call, but I called a PhD family therapist. You'll get in the story here shortly. And I said, there's been an emergency. I need to declare an emergency, and I need to see you right away. He said, I'll clear the calendar, come straight in. So I went over to his office, and said, it could have happened 5 minutes ago because I can still see it. And I walked in, and this whole event had done what it was supposed to do. It had completely destroyed me. It had completely stripped me of any will to fight, resist, deny, minimize. It was gone. It was what it was, and I recognized it as such. And so I went in, and I just told him straight out what had happened. And I remember he kind of pulled back a little bit in some shock and surprise. And he said, God, Lyle, he said, this is horrible. This is just horrible. This is now March the 9th. It's Friday, March the 9th. I was going to hear two comments that day, neither one of which I could mentally process. And I heard the first one now, because he started around his desk, and I remember he stopped, and he looked to his left at me, and he said, but maybe this is what had to happen. I had no idea why he would say that to me. I didn't know where that fit in anything, and I couldn't respond. Short while later, he said, there's a doctor I want you to go see tonight. He said, I was on staff with him. He's a prominent doctor here in Atlanta. He's a psychiatrist. He's an alcoholic cocaine addict and recovering, and he's certified in addiction medicine, which I had never, ever heard of. Didn't know there was such a thing. He said, I've got you set up to see him tonight at 6 o'clock. Now, this is a Friday, and even in the shredded mental condition that I was in, that registered. I knew that doctors don't typically see patients at 6 on Friday nights. And it conveyed a certain sense of urgency. I picked up on that. Later, he told me, he said, based on your appearance, it was imperative that I get you over there because I was afraid you were a suicide. And I thought, you know, I don't know what I looked like or sounded like, but I'm already starting to have dark thoughts about all of this. So Barbara and I went over there on the other side of Atlanta, and I have absolutely no recall of that meeting, no active memory of that meeting. I can't tell you how long I was in there. And I hadn't had anything to eat or drink for 2 days at this point. But it's just like a complete total alcoholic blackout, and I've had many, many of those. I know I was there, and I know that at that point in time, every time he asked me something, I gave him an honest answer as best I could. And at some point in that interview, that process, he turned to me and he looked at me. Pardon me. He said, Lyle, you're an alcoholic. And he said, you need to get into treatment tonight. I told him about my parents, told him about some other things. He said, you need to get into treatment tonight. And the thing that really registered was that I had no reaction because I've hated alcoholics since I saw what they did in my family. I saw what they did in my community, Native American community. And I've just hated alcoholics, felt nothing but disgust and repugnancy. That word came up. And I felt nothing when he told me I was an alcoholic because somehow, some way that I'll never understand, in the 24 hours since the arrest, in a way that I'll never get, I knew. The dots inside it had connected, and I knew exactly what I was. And I told him, I said, I thought you would tell me that, and I'm okay with it. But I said, I just got home today. I said, please let me go home and let Barbara just hang on to me. Let my mind uncoil. Let me absorb what's happened, and then I'll go into treatment. He said, you need to get into treatment tonight. And I paused and took a breath and looked at him and said, okay. So we went back across town, following another set of directions to a treatment center I'd never heard of. Of course, I had no reason to know about any of them. But we made the final turn to the treatment center, and there was a sign that was right there on the corner, and it was right in front of my headlights when I made the turn, and I hit the brakes and stopped. And it's like many of the things that we do when we write these things down. When we put them on paper, we write them down and they're in front of us. We read them. There is a real sense of reality that hits at that point, and it did for me at that moment. And it said Anchor Hospital, a hospital for alcoholism and other chemical dependencies. And it was like I got kicked right in the guts as I sat and looked at that. I thought, my God Almighty, my God Almighty. My life ends tonight in a treatment center for alcoholics. I'm 51 years old. What happened? How did I get here? What happened? And I had a little quick mini flashback over the years of my life. The really bright parts, the trophy moments, the things that were high on my resume, my personal resume, that I had accomplished, mostly against the odds. And these were things that were... They gave me honor and glory, reputation. And it was like somebody took a giant eraser and wiped them out. And I wasn't even sure as I sat there if those had actually existed and occurred. And I remember feeling zero value as a human being, none, no self-worth. I didn't count. Some years later, I read a summarizing paragraph at the end of a lengthy report from one of the doctors in that treatment center. And he said, given the history and background of this man, it was unlikely to believe he would ever be a productive member of society. And I remember kind of flinching when I saw that because that surprised me. And excuse me, I thought, God darn, that's a pretty dismal conclusion to come to. Then I thought, my second thought was, well, I was the one that gave him all the information. So we started down the hill into the treatment center. It was at night. It was dark. And I thought, holy cow. All of a sudden, it occurred to me, this is March the 9th. And the trauma and the distress of everything that had happened that had not registered. And I thought, this is March the 9th. This is my 27th wedding anniversary. And I said to Barbara, I said, hell of a way to spend an anniversary, huh? I then heard the second statement that I couldn't process very softly. She said, might be the best one we ever had. And I couldn't grasp that, because it was clear to me at that moment that my life was gone. It was completely destroyed. It could never be rebuilt. It could never be rebuilt. And I knew that. And I didn't know how she could come up and manufacture a thought like that. And I didn't say anything. So we just started down the hill to the treatment center. Now, I normally lighten this up a little bit and tell you, a few years ago, March the 9th rolled around. It was a morning just about like this in Georgia. Beautiful, nice, cool morning, blue skies. And up the driveway, about 9 in the morning, one of my sponsees came driving up. And I said, what are you doing here? He said, I've heard your story. It's March the 9th. It's your anniversary. And I just thought I'd kind of spring in here and surprise you and wish you a happy anniversary. I said, come on in. Barb had coffee going. We were sitting around talking, enjoying ourselves. He said, well, what's the secret for having stayed married so long? And Barbara was faster than I was, and she said, she says, mostly due to the fact that I could never stand to admit I made a mistake. I told the same story here in York a couple of weekends ago. I've never considered her a master of the one-liner, but she comes up with stuff at the most unexpected times. And I was speaking last year at the Whitworth Women's Prison, South Georgia. It's about a 4 or 5 hour drive down there. And I was, I don't know how many of you have been to a women's prison, but let me tell you, when you're looking at 30, 40, 50 women out there in prison garb, they do not look like the ladies in this audience here look like. They, big difference. And so I'm talking to them, and I'm maybe a third of the way into the story, and one of them yells out from the audience. She yells out. She goes, you're hot. And that stops me in my tracks, and I'm sitting and standing there for a moment or two, and about 3 or 4 more of them yell out, yeah, you're hot. So I regroup, and I get through this story, and Barbara's asleep by the time I get home, so we're having coffee the next morning. And I'm telling her about this. I said, you're not going to believe what happened last night. So I tell her about this. She looks at me and she says, they must have been locked up a really long time. I always seem to set these traps for myself and just step right into it. I was born in Wichita, Kansas, in September 1938, so I'm 1 month away from 77. I don't have a problem with that, except it's a big number. It got here really fast. And I just get the age out there because I know that I'm never the only one sitting there trying to figure out how old the speaker is. I do it every time I'm sitting there. And usually I do. By the time the story's over, there have been a couple of dates and times and places, and so I've got it pretty well nailed down. But I've noticed that the AA women are by far the most devious, and I don't know if that's intent, gender, or a plan or what, but they will do things like say, I graduated from college, and I immediately think that's 21 or 22, the same year that John Kennedy was assassinated. I'm going, it's 63 minus 21. Or I had my first child, I was 24, it was 2 years after Neil Armstrong walked on the moon or something like that. And I'm going, well, when the hell was that? Was that 68 or 68 or 69? So I'm doing the math. All throughout her talk, I'm doing the math. And she leaves the stage, and I'm going, I don't know, she's either 43 or 68, one or the other. So I just get it out of the way. I grew up in a World War II housing project on the southeast edge of Wichita called Plainview. It was a very economically poor area. Poor is a subjective term, and I don't know that I was poor based on some of the things that I've seen. If I'm on a reservation and I'm looking at homes that have corrugated tin roofs or no running water or anything, I wasn't poor by those standards. But everybody there was economically depressed. I remember, we never had anything, really. Everything we had was third rate, and it was patched, broken, taped, repaired. But I also remember, this was in the 50s, and I also remember that was the happiest time of my childhood. I was really happy there. It was a very diverse community, blacks, whites, Hispanics, small Native American segment, and everybody got along. There were no gangs that I was aware of. Drugs were very scant, almost unheard of back then. Only a very few times I ever heard about any trouble in that area with among all these various groups. And it was just a good time to be a kid, and I have happy memories of that. I'm an ethnic mix. I was part of the Native American segment. I was an ethnic mix of several different things. But the two parts that seem to really dominate when I'm drinking are either the Irish parts or the Comanche parts. And they show up and they take over. And I always thought it was an okay mix. You know, we don't get a chance to go out and pick our parents. And I love the Irish stuff because I love that music and those songs, those spirited music and Freedom Rebel and drinking songs. And a lot of times when I was driving around the country, I knew where those places were, those live Irish authentic bands. And I changed clothes 5 minutes later, I'd be out the door, and I would sit there and sing along and be there and drink along, and I'd literally be the last guy out the door after the band closed. Just had a heck of a time. Just really loved that stuff. And then maybe I'd be someplace and those places weren't available, or the mood was different. And it was just something would kick in, and I'd think, this would be a good evening, just go have a few drinks and kill some white people. And so you just never knew. I grew up in my native culture. I was a powwow guy, dancer. I knew the songs and traditions. I have gone back to that since getting sober. There are a number of Native American sobriety programs around this country now, none of which existed when I was young and growing up that I was aware of. And so there's a good, strong Native American sobriety movement underway. But considering the overall picture, it's really a drop in the bucket. But at least it's a start, and I get to be part of some of those programs and those activities. When I was 14, my parents' alcoholism had reached the zenith. It had peaked out, and the family completely imploded and was destroyed. And they got a divorce, which really affected me and my sister, who was 2 years younger than I am. And within the next 3 years, each of them had been married and divorced two more times. I didn't like step-parents or step-siblings. I didn't get along well and would have clashes and conflicts and would be asked to go to the other family, which I would go over there and something would happen. I'd ricochet back over here. And faces would change and names would change. I don't remember any of them. And that's how I kind of traversed through high school. My sister and I were pretty much all on our own. Nobody watched. Nobody cared. And so I squandered an awful lot of academic opportunity I could have had in high school because there was no oversight, and I took advantage of it. I never go to the podium, though, without thanking my parents. They died bad deaths, and I saw what happened in the family. But I look at the days that they weren't drunk, that before the alcoholism killed them. And I look at the things that they gave my sister and me, the things they taught us, much of which I still have today that hold me in good stead. And so I always owe a debt of gratitude to my parents. And I always try to thank them from the podium for the good things they gave me that I still have. I graduated when I was 17. And not too many people went to college from my part of the city. And most of them married their little high school sweethearts and went to work at the aircraft factories that Wichita is known for, Boeing, Beech, Cessna, and there were several more at the time. And I had decided I was going to join the service, but I wasn't sure what. About that time, one of my friends came back from the Marine Corps, and he was right out of boot camp, home on leave, and I was impressed with him. He looked sharp and was snappy, and I thought, wow, what a change. And we sat in a bar one afternoon for 3 or 4 hours, and he detailed his boot camp experience with me over beer. And there was just one brutal, sadistic story after another after what Marine drill instructors do to their recruits in boot camp during the 13 weeks. And I'm just hanging on every edge. I had just turned 18, and I thought, you know, I just can't wait to go do that. And early indication that maybe my thinking wasn't always really on top of things. And within a couple of days, I'd signed on the dotted line, and off I went to Marine boot camp. The two things that I always hear, almost always hear, not always, but a great deal of the time from speakers at the podium, are that I never fit in, and the minute I took that first drink, the magic happened. Those are not parts of my story. Those are true for the people who come up and tell you that, but that was not my personal experience. I went to Marine boot camp, and after I got over the initial culture shock and snapped into the routine, I loved it. It was incredibly intense. I see a guy out here with a Marine Corps hat, Semper Fi. And only if you've gone through Marine Corps boot camp do you understand what I'm talking about. It's not a put down on the other services, but their boot camp is not like Marine Corps boot camp. And I got in there, and I loved it. It was an amazing experience. It was extraordinary. It was extreme. It was intense. And for the first time in my life, I experienced that thing called camaraderie, that esprit de corps, that band of brothers, that belonging, that inextricable bond that one Marine has with another. And I had never seen or experienced that before, and I loved it. And I knew where I belonged. I knew where I was going to stay. I was going to be a Marine from here on out. And all I was trying to do was just do my best and make it through the 13-week experience. At the end of the 13 weeks, drill instructors called out three names of the three top guys, and my name was the second name called. I was taken by surprise. I had no idea. All I wanted to do was complete. I didn't know I was doing that well. So I get a PFC stripe along with the other two guys, and that's private first class. That is not heavy rank. You cannot run the Marine Corps as a private first class. But I couldn't take my eyes off of that red-bordered stripe that I had. I kept looking at that going, wow, private PFC Prowse, PFC Prowse, that's something. Because all my buddies are still slick-sleeve privates. We go to Camp Pendleton, and the first time we get there, we draw guard duty. My buddies are out in the rain walking post with a rifle over their shoulder. I'm inside a Quonset because I'm acting corporal of the guard. And I look over, and there's the first lieutenant's uniform in the corner. And I remember seeing that and sliding back and thinking, God darn it, you know, at the rate I'm going, general can't be that far away. And this is where I'm staying. And I did. I always excelled. My drinking career, my drinking pattern escalates throughout the course of this story. But I'm always in a heavy drinking environment. I'm in a place where we're supposed to be able to drink. I'm with my Marine buddies. We're supposed to be able to drink. Later, I'm a fighter pilot. We're supposed to be able to drink. Later, I'm an airline pilot. We're supposed to be able to drink. Towards the end, my drinking pulls away from the rest of the crowd. But for a good part of my drinking career, it did not. Nor did I have the experiences and the consequences that many of my friends had. That would have been a good tipping point. But I had near misses, many, many near misses. I wasn't the guy getting divorces. I wasn't the guy flunking check rides. I wasn't the guy getting DUIs, DWIs up in Minnesota. Now, I did get two of those. They were separated by about 5 or 6 years. And I was convinced it could happen to anybody. That was my one mantra. That could happen to anybody. And I get into treatment and I start making a first step inventory. I'm going, Jesus Christ, all that can't happen to one person. And I had a good Indian buddy who told me one time he was in court for his sixth DWI, number six. And it was at that point he learned that DWI did not stand for drinking with Indians. And four and a half years into my Marine Corps career, I'm promoted meritoriously, Lance Corporal, and I go into my unit. My commanding officer took me into a room and said, there's a new program out called Marine Aviation Cadet. It's a brand new program. You're the only guy in the unit who has entry scores that are high enough to go test for that program called GCT scores. And I said, I'd like to go test. I'd always wanted to fly, but I also knew that flying was not really on my lifetime radar scope. Reality-wise, it wasn't really there. Pilots that I knew of had college educations. They came from good families. They didn't come out of a World War II housing project, a Native American segment, an alcoholic home. But he's laying this opportunity in front of me, and I said, I'd like to go try. So I went over, and it was an all-day thing, and I passed. And he said, there's some other stuff you need to know. He said, you're coming in the back door as an enlisted Marine, being able to take a test. He said, 99% of these other people coming in are from the civilian side, the street side. They've got to have 2 years college minimum just to come in the door. And he said, those will be your people you'll be in this program competing with. The other thing is, it's an 18-month program. It is highly, rapidly intense, rapidly paced, and traditionally about half don't make it. And I could do the thinking on that. I thought, I'm in that high half of not making it area because I'm starting off way behind educationally. I got a big deficit there. But I wanted to fly, and I said, I'd like to fly. I'd like to try. I went home to Wichita. They were having a powwow. I went out. I was called out for an honoring dance because I was going to Pensacola the next day. And that dance really impacted me because all the way down to Pensacola, I kept thinking, there's no way I can come back to this Native community early because I didn't make it, because I washed out, because I failed. I cannot do that. And so I was driven with that. One of the things that my parents gave me was an ability to really work hard, whether it's working in the mud and the dirt and sweat or applying myself academically or any place. I know how to do my best and go the extra mile, and I owe that to them. And so there are four phases in flight training at that time, and I was driven with this fear of failure. And in every one of those phases, I was the number two guy. Now, I never got cocky or complacent or confident. I was watching my friends wash out weekly, sometimes daily. I'll never forget. I don't think one of them ever met my eyes as they came to say goodbye with their sea bag over their shoulder, saying goodbye to me. I don't think any of them ever looked me in the eye. And they walked away. Their dreams were gone. They wanted to fly as badly as I did. But for whatever reason, they were not able to do it. And every time they walked away, I thought, at some point, that will be me. And so I continued to push ahead. And I'm drinking really hard. Now, after we get out of pre-flight, which is that phase of the movie that you saw in An Officer and a Gentleman, once we're out of there, we got liberty. And every weekend, I'm out with my buddies, and we are just rip-roaring drunk. I do not remember ever drinking without getting drunk. Now, that can't be true, or I'd be dead probably, but I only drink to get drunk every single time. But at that point, there was something I wanted called gold wings. And so I would shut my drink off. Friday night, Saturday night, I was just out tearing it up. Sunday, I'm not. I'm studying. I'm getting ready to start off on Monday because I've got a big load to haul that coming week. The big book talks about how we could manage our drinking at some point. The last 6 months, I leave the Florida area and I go to Texas for advanced jet flight training. The final 6 months, if I can just complete this phase, I'm done. I get my wings and my gold bars. The first night I get into town, it's a little town called Beeville, Texas. Advanced jet flight training there. I hook up with a bunch of my friends, and we just get rip-roaring drunk at the officer's club. And then they said, let's go into town. There's a little place in town here called Canes. C-A-I-N-S. Canes Drive-In. That's where all the good-looking South Texas girls hang out, and we've got an inside track, because we're going to be pilots and officers. And I said, okay. And I'd never been very gutsy or aggressive with the gals, but I'd had a lot to drink. So I went in with them, and they immediately, three of my buddies went after this carload of girls. Then I hung back drinking. I noticed the driver wasn't talking to anybody. I couldn't see her real well. I was looking at an angle. But I sat back there, stood back there and drank, rehearsed a few things that exceeded my normal level of cleverness. And I was surprised, and I walk up to the car. I'm going to spring these on her, and I'm thinking, you know, as good as this stuff is, she may just take her clothes off sitting there. And so I walk up, and she turns and looks at me, and she's a good-looking gal, and everything vacates. I don't know where it goes. I'm just empty now. I'm vacant, and I'm standing there, and she's got some look on her face like, well, and I said, you got the prettiest brown eyes I've ever seen, except it didn't come out well. I hadn't been practicing that part, and it goes, as you get as eyes. And she looks at me like I just peed on the side of her car, and I turned around and walked off. I was embarrassed, and I thought anybody that's that drunk where you can't talk should be beyond the pale of being embarrassed. That should be gone, but it wasn't. So I walked back there, and I just stood there and drank. I thought, I'm not going back. A little while later, she got out of the car, and I saw her walk in. And, man, I was impressed. She had she had turquoise shorts on. I remember that. Cute little butt. Pretty legs. And I'm thinking, God darn, all that. And on top of that, nice smiling brown eyes. That's a package. And I had an AA thought. Now, I didn't know it was an AA thought. I really did. I did not know it was an AA thought for 29 more years. But she was walking in there, and I'm taking this all in. I'm thinking, I really want what she has, and I'm willing to go to any length to get it. And I had a chance encounter with her the next day, and I had a buddy with me. She had a girlfriend, and I was scared and nervous, but I was sober. And she let me buy her a cup of coffee and told me her name was Barbara, and that I could call her, and she and I began dating. And on February the 25th of 63, her 20th birthday, she pinned these gold wings right here, right over my heart, pinned on two gold bars. Man, Hollywood couldn't have scripted a better day. It was a perfect day. I had my wings. I had my commission. I'd come a long way from being an 18-year-old Marine private, and now a second lieutenant, commissioned officer, and fighter pilot. And we went home to Kansas for leave, and as the leave was coming to an end, I called her. She was staying with my sister. I said, "You're going back to Texas. I've got orders to California. Let's go get married." She said, "Okay." So we drove down to Newkirk, Oklahoma, stood in front of a justice of peace, and got married. This last March the 9th came around. It was 52 years for us, because she can't stand to admit she made a mistake. She joined me out in California. She was youngest Marine wife out there, squadron wife. She was 20 years old, instantly pregnant, which I considered part of my duty as a Marine. And we had a little boy. 8 days, less than a year later, we had a second little boy. And people come up and go, "You guys Catholic?" I go, "No, we're just horny Protestants, and we don't have any problems." So I got orders to Vietnam. We were one of the first Marine jet squadrons into Vietnam in 1965. And I left Barbara with those two little babies, and I went to a place called Chu Lai, Vietnam, 52 miles, 56 miles south of Da Nang. Carved out of the beach, the sand, with a little portable runway that was half of what we needed. We were living in tents, heating sea rations out of small cans. It was a typical Marine Corps combat setup. The perimeter secured all by Marines in foxholes. Everything beyond that perimeter was enemy-owned, VC-controlled. And we flew off that little landing strip with jet assist takeoffs, and we landed into carrier gear because we were all carrier qualified. No creature comforts, very primitive setting, but we flew amazing combat missions, and I was with 28 of the finest men that will ever be my honor and privilege to be with, and I'll never have that experience again. And we acquitted ourselves extraordinarily well while we were over there. I put in for a regular commission, knowing full well that the Marine Corps does not give, they were very competitive, does not give regular commissions to officers with no college, and I got a regular commission. And I look at that and I go, you know, that's been my history. That's been what I expect of myself. That's what others expect of me, to go above and beyond, to go the extra mile, to do the extra work. I'm not supposed to go into a bar in Fargo and disgrace myself and become a national pariah and lose everything that I've worked a lifetime to get. But once I hit that alcoholic phase, I lose the ability to call the shots. I cannot manage the things that I want to do any longer. That's just the reality of this disease, and that's what happened to me. I came back. I stayed in for another 2.5 years. I got out because of family separation. It was going to be required, and I had promised Barbara that we will not have a family like the one I grew up in. And so I made a decision to resign that commission. It was a painful decision. Barbara didn't push me to do it, and I got out in July of 68, and 3 weeks later, I was in class at Northwest Airlines. And for 22 years at Northwest, I had the same kind of parallel career that I had in the Marine Corps. I loved going to work. It was a fun job. I couldn't wait to go. Loved working with the guys in the cockpit. I loved the flight attendants in the back. It was just a great job, and I couldn't wait to go. and then all the wheels came off. Excuse me. Right after we got to the airlines, we had decided to adopt a little girl. Barbara had wanted a daughter. We talked about it even before we got married. We had the two boys, so we put in really hard, put a hard push in to adopt this little girl. It was difficult because we already had these two biological boys. And 14 months later, we got this little Indian girl who came to live in our house when she was 17 days old. And we had fought a hell of a fight, and that's why we got her. And Barbara now had her daughter. We had the perfect everything, the perfect family, the perfect neighborhood finally, the perfect job and career. Everything was perfect. And she was the most beautiful little girl I've ever seen, and she couldn't walk past me without me picking her up. And her name was Dawn. And I'd say, "God, she was beautiful." And I'd look in that face, and I'd say, "Thanks for being my girl." And she'd say, "Thanks for being my dad." And when she was 17 years old, she ran away from home. I didn't see it coming. Barbara didn't see it coming. Have no idea if drinking had anything to do with it. I don't deny it. I just simply don't know. Barbara was a wonderful mom. And we had really, I thought, done a good job with the kids. And I put off being a captain for 2 years as she came up to graduation for high school because I didn't want to be gone during her last years at home. And as she was getting ready to graduate, I went to Chicago and took the special written test to become a captain. And that afternoon, when Barbara had taken me to the airport, She came with some of her friends, got what she wanted, left a runaway note, and Barbara didn't see it until late that night. And I called home the next day, and Barbara told me about it, and I panicked. I just panicked. God, I couldn't believe my little girl was gone. And I blurted out where to go and where to look and who to call and who to talk to. And I got on the airplane. And 2 hours later, I was back in Atlanta. And I do not remember anything happening to me on that flight. I don't remember any kind of transition period or anything. But when I got off the airplane, I hated her. I absolutely hated her. And the hatred was absolutely white hot. I've never hated anyone as much as I hated the daughter that had once been the center of my universe. And I told Barbara, I said, I don't care if she dies in the streets. I said, she'll never come back to my house. And I said, I never want her name mentioned ever in my presence. And I told the rest of the family that. Nobody dared mention her. Within 2 days, everything she'd ever owned, all of her furniture, belongings, had gone to Goodwill. There was no physical trace she'd ever been in my home. I went to the safety deposit box. I ripped up her adoption papers. I went to an attorney and gave him $500 and disowned her. And I tried to annul the adoption and couldn't. And in the midst of this tornadic activity, in a way that's only barely insanely amusing, I looked around here, assessed this whole thing. I thought, you know, I don't think Barbara's handling this too well. She probably needs a therapist. And I got in the Yellow Pages, and by the luck of the draw, pulled a name out, and we got this PhD doctor. And he was a good therapist. And we saw him twice a month for almost 2 years. I didn't like talking about my daughter. And one time he was trying to get me to talk about her, and I blurted out a statement that I had never consciously formed in my mind. I never had this thought ever that I knew of, but it painted me. It was a one-sentence statement that absolutely portrayed who I was. And I said to him, I'm going to tell you something, doctor. I would rather hate than hurt. And I thought, that's exactly. And he looked at me. He said, you survived a childhood doing that, and if you continue, it'll destroy you. There was nothing he told us that didn't come true. Nothing that he told us that didn't happen. I got into treatment. I thought, that's what I've always done. That's what I've always done, because I learned early on that as a guy, as a man, that I'm not subject to pain or vulnerability as long as I can call up the anger. That when something when I feel that something is not going to happen my way, when I think there's a possibility of pain, I get angry real fast, and the walls come up, and they're high enough and thick enough, and pain does not penetrate because I'm angry. I'm just angry. And so I never feel pain. I just feel anger. That's my coping mechanism. The alcohol quit working for me. Now all I wanted to do was drink alone. I get to any town in the country. It doesn't make any difference where they were. I knew where the nearest liquor store was, how long it took me to change clothes, get up there, and get back to my room with a quart of booze. I locked the door, turned the TV on. If the crew member called on the phone, I wouldn't answer. If they knocked on the door, I wouldn't go to the door. I just wanted to drink. And I don't know about you, but I mix drinks really strong. I don't like them straight, but I like them strong. And usually, many times, that first drink is a struggle to get down. I may have to choke and gag a little bit to get that one down because it's that strong. But once it is down, the rest of them go really smoothly. And I can go through a quart of booze really fast. But instead of getting that, recapturing that high that always worked for me, that warm golden glow, that just lessening of everything inside where nothing is a problem, everything lets go, it's okay. It may not be okay for long, but it's okay right now. I could never recapture that. I never got it once back ever. Because what I was doing, every time I slugged the drink down, I might as well had a Bunsen burner, a fuel stove right here in my gut, because it was like I was pouring gas on it. And up came the hatred, the bitterness, the resentment, the self-pity, the martyrdom, this long list of things that I had done for 17 years of this little girl's life as a result of being her dad. And look how she repaid me. And by the time I got to the end of the bottle, I was emotionally spent and exhausted. I was wiped out. I was wasted. And the very next night, in a different town, I would do it again and again and again and again, always with the same result. And that's pretty much where we were when this arrest took place. I'm in treatment, and I don't want anybody to know who I am or what I am. It was a week before anybody knew the color of my eyes, because I couldn't look up, wouldn't look up. On about day two of treatment, or three, one of those days, it's all over the media. Now everybody in the treatment center knows who I am. And the shame is just all over me. And I don't even know how I managed to get my clothes on to go to the various activities. I couldn't sleep at night. The nights had a million hours. And I would just lay there in torture, just self-torture. And the first week, I went into a group, not intending to talk, not intending not to talk. And I really wanted to buy into this thing. I wanted so badly to believe what they were telling me about the big book, the 12 and 12, the 12 steps. I really wanted this to all be true, but I just didn't know. I wasn't resisting. I was hoping. I went into a group, 8 or 10 of us. They closed the door, and for some reason, I began to talk about my daughter, and I didn't have that wall of pain, and I broke down and sobbed. I didn't cry at my parents' funerals. I had an email several years ago. My sister said, I grew up with you. I didn't think anything could ever make you cry. And I cried that day because I didn't have anything to block the pain, and I took it straight on the way I should have for the first time in my life. And then I felt embarrassed. But it's one of the best things that ever happened to me in treatment because it has nothing to do with how tough I am or how tough I'm not. But I began to feel that day. I began to start feeling again that day. And I wrote to Barbara. I said, let's get a hold of Don. Let's put the family back together again. No visitors, no phone calls, this treatment center. They heard about this. I said, we'll give you a day room and let this happen if you can make it happen. So some days later, they said, your daughter is here. Your family's here. And the two doctors had asked if they could please come see this. And I walked into this day room. I saw my daughter for the first time in 2 years. And I walked over and put my arms around her. And told her how much I loved her instead of how much I hated her. And in her arms was a 5-month-old granddaughter that I didn't really know anything about. My daughter got married and I didn't even know her last name. I wish I could report that all has been healed and well in that time. It hasn't been. Her life is a mess today. She's made one bad choice after another, not alcohol or drug related that I'm aware of. But her life is a mess and there's nothing we can do about it. But I have a program called Alcoholics Anonymous that allows me to accept. This program is about me, not her. It's about me. I don't live her life for her. I give her the freedom to live her life and her journey as it is. And while I'm hurt, sad, disappointed, and heartbroken over it, I accept it. And it is what it is. She still calls home and says, hi, Daddy, I love you. I said, I love you too, sweetie. But I do nothing to enable her. We don't send money. We don't help her out. It's not helping. It's enabling. So we don't do any of that. But I'm okay today. I can do that. I go through 6 crises there in the treatment center that unfolded that were completely unanticipated, and they're legal stuff. I knew the FA was going to react. A week to the day that I went into treatment, a patient came and informed me there were 2 TV sets. I wouldn't go near either one of them. Said, they just announced on TV that Northwest has terminated you. FAA's done an emergency revocation of all your flight certificates. You've lost your FAA medical certificate because of your alcoholism. So I'm stripped naked bare of all my flying credentials. They're all gone. And it was all fair. It was all appropriate. Again, when you do what you did, you get what you got. suddenly, I'm getting word that there's criminal prosecution. And none of the attorneys knew anything about this at the beginning. And I go through 6 of these crises where Minnesota's indicting me, North Dakota's indicting me, Minnesota's doubling the charges, North Dakota's doubling the charges. Federal marshals are coming down to take me out of the treatment center in handcuffs. And finally, the 6th one, I step out, there's a doctor out there, and I thought, uh-oh, there's never been a doctor. We go down to his office, he said, Lyle, I have to tell you, my counselor's there. He said, I have to tell you, federal grand jury has now just indicted you. You're looking at 15 years in federal prison, a $250,000 fine, and an attorney's coming in Sunday wants $50,000, which I didn't have. We went broke in the first 30 days. I had grown up with nothing, and now I had taken Barbara with me back to nothing. We had nothing, we were broke. He said, I have to ask you if you're going to hurt yourself. And I said, no, I won't. And I go back to my room. I don't remember collapsing, but I remember for the second time in treatment, I'm crying. But my head is on the carpet. I'm laying there, side of my head on the carpet, and I'm crying. And I said, God, I can't do this anymore. This is 6 times. I've got nothing left for not even one more time. I have nothing left. Please help me. And I remember sleeping that night. I had many, many, many experiences in treatment, none of which I have the time to go into. Because I bought into this thing. I really wanted this to be true. I wanted so hard to believe this. I get out of treatment, and I'm immediately in a very heavily publicized 3-week trial. I have a story with an attorney that I'd love to share, but again, I can't in the interest of time. And I had wanted to plead guilty. I had taken responsibility from day one. He said, it's not a wise move legally. And he explained why, and I said, okay. So I told him, I said, I'm going to be found guilty, Peter, and when I am, it will be okay. I will be okay. We draw the toughest judge in the Minnesota Federal District, which was consistent with all the luck that I had throughout this entire thing. I never got a break. Anytime there was a decision point, a possible this or that, left or right, it never once, not once ever, did it go the way I was hoping it would go. Not once ever. And so we're engaged in this three-week trial, and this is a media sensation. There are TV cameras everywhere. There is no route that we can take to the courthouse. There is no place we can go for lunch where the media isn't sticking cameras and microphones in my face. Now, I had an advantage over the other two guys because I'm the alcoholic. That's an advantage for me because I'm in meetings every night that I'm not in a courtroom. I'm in meetings. And at first it was scary because they recognized me. And I would just sit and I'd listen to you share. I would never share it. I just was there. But it was enough energy to get me through that trial. And as I would approach these throng of reporters that were screaming and yelling and sticking cameras, I would mantra the serenity prayer as fast as I could, as many times as I could in my mind, and I could feel something in here loosen. It didn't go away. I was still scared. I was still terrified, but something loosened a little bit as a result of that. So I had tools that the other two did not have as I went through this trial. I'm in this trial, which is indescribable. The media is picking the prosecutor. He's telling the world what a no good piece of crap I am, always have been, always will be. And the media is picking it up. It's in all the tabloids. It's on all, it's being printed everywhere, and I can't do anything about it. I have no recourse. And sometimes I would look across the courtroom as this is taking place, and Barbara would be there, and she would look at me. She would mouth the words, "I love you." And I'd just nod, and I'd be okay. I'd be okay. The jury went out. The jury came back very quickly. I knew what that meant. I was a captain, so everything came to me first. Then the judge announces a sentence of guilty. My attorney standing to my right, he flinches, and I reached over and just kind of patted him like that, and I said, "It's okay, Peter. It's okay." We went back for the sentencing. Sentencing guidelines were in place at that time. They no longer are. 12 months to 18 months, I was a captain. I knew I was going to get 18 months. I've been in treatment with a federal judge who cornered me every chance he got and says, "There are some things you need to know about how we do things." And it's kind of like, you know, I didn't want to go to open heart surgery and have him show me a video of the film before I get it. Show me afterwards, you know. But he's telling me all this stuff, so I'm aware. He said, "The sentencing is a charade." He said, when you go in there, he said, "No matter what, you'll talk to your attorney." He says, "We never change from the bench. When we come through the door, sentence is set." And there have been other judges and attorneys around the country that corroborate. They said, "That is true. That is true." Because they researched everything. They know it's accurate. And it's going to there. Never change from the bench. So a day and a half before sentencing, the judge notifies all the attorneys that he's going to depart upward from the sentencing guidelines. He had strong feelings about this case, and I saw them every day, and he was entitled to those. And so my attorney said, "My God," he said, "he can go all the way to 15 years now. He can depart upward as far as he wants to go." And I knew it was going to be bad. And I told Barbara, I said, "This is about step one. I'm powerless over this. This is all about acceptance. I cannot do anything. I must accept what happens." So that morning of sentencing, he'd lectured. And I was the first to stand up. And I didn't know even as I stood up what I was going to talk about. I was so scared. But I talked about being grateful to be sober. I was grateful for the things that happened to my family. I'd accepted responsibility for this from day one. I couldn't change anything. And to everyone's dismay and surprise, he announced a sentence on me of 16 months, 2 months less under the guidelines. It blew everyone away. And there's a beautiful story behind that that I don't have time to go into. I couldn't believe it. And he then did something. The other two got 12 months. The other thing that he did was he said, "I'd given my personal effects to Barbara," and said, "I think he'll have us led away for the TV cameras, going to handcuffed and going to prison." He said, "This is a complex trial. This is the first time this law has ever been used. It was not designed for pilots. There will be appeals." And he said, "I'll let you three men remain free until your appeals are have exhausted." The other two said that's what they would do. I said, "No, I'll go to prison now. Because this is about life on life's terms. You know, this is a first-person story where I talk about I and me, I and me, I and me. And I have to tell the story. It's never been about I or me. This is about we, us, you, me, the steps. Every one of these steps that I've learned how to use and put into place and employ at a particular time in a particular manner. That's what this has been about. And the best part of my story is that I don't get any credit for it. I just did what you asked me to do. I get no credit for anything. I had no control over anything that happened from the moment of the arrest to the end of this story. I was just there trying to do the next right thing. I said, no, I'll go to prison now. I've been convicted. It's time to go. He told my attorney later, he said, I was lost for words. He said, no defendant before or since has ever done that. He said, I was lost for words. And I said, hey, you weren't lost very long. So on December the 5th of 1990, 36 years to the day that I'd entered Marine boot camp, 34 years to the day, I went into Atlanta Federal Prison. And audiences love prison stories. I tell none of those. I had experiences there. A lot of things happened. But it has nothing to do with my recovery. My recovery has everything to do with how I dealt with the people, the situations, circumstances, and experiences that I had in prison. I spent 424 days in the prison system. And I did it one day at a time, shorter when necessary. I had a guy come up to me one time afterwards and go, 424 days. He said, man, that's nothing. He said, I was out there 18 years. I just looked at him and grinned. I said, well, I guess you win. it's a long time for me. I came out of prison. I was broke. I was stripped of everything. The judge had put sanctions on me that were worse than what the FAA had already done. They absolutely guaranteed I would never see the inside of a cockpit again, ever. I was out of prison about a year, and in another story that I don't have time to relate, the judge lifted those sanctions. Not one chance in 10,000, anybody thought, that that could occur. He lifted the sanctions. The FAA then said, if you want to fly again, you'll start with a private license, literally from the ground up. I never had a private license. I came out of the Marine Corps, had a commercial with an instrument rating immediately, and none of my pilot buddies thought it was possible. And I thought, I stay sober one day at a time. I've got four licenses to get. I'll go after the licenses one license at a time. And that's what I did. I choked it down to one license at a time. 10.5 months later, I'd passed the writtens on all four exams. They were very difficult, and it was very hard work. But I know how to do that, and I'm willing to do it. But there's a flying part that comes into play, and I couldn't do that. I looked at that, and I'm going, that's $10,000 to $20,000. I'm working at the treatment center in the counseling department. I'm making $14,000 a year. One of the best jobs I ever had, but I'm just barely staying alive. I can't do it. About that time, I get a phone call and a letter from one of my friends at Northwest. He said, I've got a flight school you don't know about. And he said, I want you to come up here and live with me and my family and go through the flight training free. I went up there and checked in with the Minnesota Department of Corrections because I'm still on probation. I spent 44 days with that man and his family. We were rained out 14 days, but I never took a day off. I just sat and studied and studied and studied. And the remaining 30 days, I flew 78 hours, and I got four licenses back. I had two of them by 11:15 one morning, and I don't think that's ever been done before. I don't know, but I don't think so. When I'm not night flying, I'm in an AA meeting, and I'm having wonderful experiences because AA is where I belong. That's my home. That's where I go. I came back with those licenses, and I thought, well, that's great, but I'll never fly on American soil. I will never fly. Everybody knows my name. They know about the Northwest Flight 650 incident. A month later, the licenses physically arrive in the mail. And within an hour of that happening, I get a phone call from the head of the union at Northwest Airline Pilot Union at Northwest. A grievance had been filed. I had never activated it because Northwest was completely fair and justified in terminating me. He said to me, this is the best phone call I've ever made because he said 3 hours ago, John Dasburg, the president and CEO of Northwest Airlines, made a personal decision to bring you back and put you back in full flight status at Northwest. I sat there with tears streaming down my cheeks. I couldn't believe this. I was hearing this. This is so far above and beyond. I had put so much shame and embarrassment on Northwest Airlines, and they're bringing me back and going to let me fly again. And I thought, what courage, what extraordinary courage. And then as I thought about it a little bit more, I thought it goes beyond extraordinary. Because what he's doing really, in effect, he's gambling his career on mine. Because if I go back and relapse, after all this publicity I've had, he will be ousted as president. See, the board of directors will kick him off, and he'll lose every seat on every board he ever sits on. Why would he take that chance? It was a risk that I am just still to this day in awe of. And I've talked to him about that, never gotten a real good answer from him. I went back. signed a very emotional back-to-work agreement, never to be a captain again, but I was okay with that. I was happy with that. At least now I'm going to be able to give Barbara a little bit of a retirement, something that was just, had been a knife in my heart. And I go back. Northwest now has a program for alcoholic pilots, and I'm part of the program. I joined that program. And my goal every day that I put that uniform on was to make sure that John Dasburg never, ever, ever, ever had an ounce of regret about his decision to bring me back. And I fulfilled that dedication, that obligation very well, I think. As I was flying, I'm certainly the most visible pilot on the property. I always had a good reputation as a pilot, but now I'm a recovering pilot. I go back, and as I'm coming up on my final year at Northwest, I'm speaking at United Airlines. I get a phone call late at night, same pilot. He said, Dasburg has just changed your back-to-work agreement. He knows you're coming up on your last year. When you come home, he wants you to check out as a 747 captain. I went back. I thought, you know, every time I think God's used up his miracles, he can show me one more. It's an amazing thing. I went back and I checked out. I spent the last year in the left seat of a 747, fully restored, fully trusted, given back everything. Never got the material goods back, but I wouldn't swap them out. Not because I'm anybody special, but only because John Dasburg knows that I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous and that I believe in this program and I try to live it. I retired honorably in 98 at the age of 60, now 65, and I knew I'd done a good job. Within a day or two of my retirement, I get a phone call from my attorney, and he said, Judge Rosenbaum, just call me. He said, he's now chief judge of the Minnesota Federal District. This is 8 years after the trial. He said, he's never supported a petition for pardon, but he said, if you want one, he'll support yours if you'll make the attempt. I thought, holy cow, never considered it. He wrote an emotional three-page affidavit that I've never been able to read without tearing up. I can't. By the time I get to page three, I got tears in my eyes. This is the man that tried me, sentenced me, and sent me to prison. I sent in the rest of the paperwork. 2 years later, I came walking in. There were 8 phone messages telling me, you just got a presidential pardon. That is better than winning the lottery. If you've got a federal felony conviction, a presidential pardon is mega huge. It is life-changing. We read the promises when we started this thing. Promises were read the second day I was in treatment at an outside AA meeting, and I remember perking up to those until they got to the part that said, no matter how far down the scale we have gone, I thought, okay, that's it for me. I'm out. I thought maybe he or she will experience this, but I never will. And I'm telling you, as I stand here right now wrapping this up, you haven't heard, but it may be 30% of this entire story. I've gotten to experience more incredible miracles than anybody I know, and they're still coming. I want to close with something that I heard Father Martin say one time, and he took it from a card that a girl had sent to him. I got to spend time at Ashley with him a number of times, and I'm sure he wouldn't object to this. But this is just a closing and a view of life as I kind of see it. And just simply this, I did not wish you joys without a sorrow, nor endless day without the healing dark, nor brilliant sun without the restful shadow, nor tides that never turn against your bark. I wish you strength and faith and love and wisdom and goods, gold enough to help some needy one. I wish you songs, but also blessed silence, and God's sweet peace when every day is done. My Comanche name is Yutzitthanop, but you know me as Lyle, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for letting me share your morning.